Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast contains graphic content and may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
True North True Crime is produced on the territories of the Coast Salish people.
I'm just here to reach out to my dog, Carissa. I just want to tell you that you have lots of people who love you and want you home. Your Aunt April is here. Your mom is here. Your dad, Shane, Vernon. Your Uncle Joey, your Aunt Chrissy, your friend Sarah's worried sick. Everybody at school, your grandmothers, everybody. Please just reach out to someone. At least call us and let you know you're okay. We all love you. And if there's anybody out there that knows, has seen her or anything, please call. The other thing I want to say is I want to thank everyone in the community that's been a support, all the businesses we both work for, and the community in general. It's been very comforting. Nothing can be done to make things better, but it's comforting to have support. The main thing is I just want somebody to come forward. If not Chris herself, somebody, let me know. It's hard to not know where your kid is.
On February 1st, 2008, the anxious mother of 12-year-old Carissa Boudreau, missing from Bridgewater, Nova Scotia, made a heartfelt plea for information to various media outlets. The town had been gripped by Carissa's disappearance since January 27th, after the teen went on a drive with her mother for a heart-to-heart conversation. During the subsequent press conference aired during the dinnertime news under the headline, "Desperate Plea from Mother," viewers couldn't ignore the mother's peculiar demeanor. Emotional one moment, seemingly unaffected the next, her actions raised eyebrows. As the news spread, rumors took root. Whispers of a lurking kidnapper, speculation about Carissa falling through the ice on the Lahav River, and even disturbing suggestions of the child being sold circulated throughout the community. However, the chilling truth unfolded closer to home than anyone could have anticipated. In tonight's episode, we're talking about the 2008 case of Carissa Boudreau. And you are listening to True North True Crime.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to True North True Crime. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Caitlin, and with me, as always, is your other host, Graham. Thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode. If you're new, welcome, and don't forget to hit subscribe or follow on your podcast platform of choice. If you have a case suggestion for us, we would love to hear from you. You can send us an email to truenorthtruecrime@gmail.com. We do prioritize cases that come to us from family members or close contacts of a case, but we do welcome suggestions from all of our listeners. For this episode, we put it together using publicly available news articles, court documents, as well as some archived news articles, but the vast majority of information came from an amazing book about this case that I want to highly recommend to our listeners. The book is called Mommy Don't, From Mother to Murderer by Sherry Aikenhead. The additional content warnings for this episode include violence against a child, filicide, suicide, suicide attempts, and substance misuse. Without further ado, let's get into this week's episode.
Penny Daw was born on September 11, 1974, in Scarborough, Ontario, to parents Barry Daw and Sharon O'Reilly. Penny was an only child, and unfortunately her parents divorced when she was quite young. This was not the only trauma that Penny would endure as a child. At the age of 11, Penny got the news that her mother Sharon had died by suicide. Penny and her father Barry relocated to the east coast of Canada, specifically Cape Sable Island, a remote island at the southern tip of Nova Scotia, known for fishing and more specifically as the lobster capital of the world, at least according to the locals. Penny's father Barry worked at the fishing plant in Clark's Harbor while raising his only daughter, and when Penny was 12, her father met a local woman named Marcia, who had two children of her own. In her teenage years, Penny attended Barrington Municipal High School and worked part-time at both Tim Hortons and Sobeys. It was at Sobeys that Penny met 23-year-old Paul Boudreau, and the two dated briefly, 4 months to be exact. During their short relationship, Penny got pregnant and gave birth to a baby girl when she was just 21 years old. The relationship was short-lived, partly because Penny was attracted to Paul's younger brother Shane, and the two began a relationship while Penny was pregnant. Penny and Paul's daughter Carissa Boudreau was born on October 4, 1995. Both of their families were delighted by the new arrival, so Penny moved back in with her father Barry and stepmom Marcia. The new grandparents relished their granddaughter and were more than happy to have Penny and Carissa under their roof while Penny worked and saved up to buy her own mobile home. Shane Boudreau was there for Penny throughout the pregnancy and after Carissa was born, so when Shane proposed, Penny happily accepted. The two tied the knot on a summer's day at the West Head Wesleyan Church in Clark's Harbor, Nova Scotia. Carissa was 4 years old at the time and wore a white satin dress to the ceremony.
As long as anyone could remember, Carissa loved animals and had big dreams of becoming a veterinarian. Carissa also loved church and attended Sunday school at the same church that Penny got married in. And it was there that Carissa met Denise Nickerson, who was one of her very first best friends. The two girls started school at the same time at Clark's Harbor Elementary and had every single class together. In the book, Mommy Don't, Denise said, "I can't remember a time in my life without her. I saw her every day." As the years went on, Penny decided to move her and Carissa in with Shane Boudreau. By all accounts, Shane was an excellent father to Carissa and always treated her like she was his own. Shane was working at the largest employer in Bridgewater, the Michelin tire plant, and with the money he earned, he bought a house for his new family on the outskirts of Bridgewater. Carissa was over the moon, having her very own bedroom and a big backyard to play in. As Carissa finished the fifth grade, she got hit with the unfortunate news that her mother, Penny, and Shane decided to split up after 7 years of marriage. The next couple of years were likely a shock to the system for Carissa, who was now traveling between her parents' homes, but spending the majority of her time with her biological father, Paul Boudreau, and his new wife and her children. But by late 2007, Carissa had decided that she wanted to move back in with her mother, Penny. This came from a desire to live in a larger town as she began her transition from elementary school into junior high, and after some thought, Penny and Paul agreed to this move. Penny was now living in an apartment at 220 Jubilee Road with a new boyfriend, Vernon McCumber. It was November of 2007 when Carissa moved in, and while things seemed to be going well at her new school, Bridgewater Elementary, things weren't ideal at home. Penny, now 33 years old, was not used to the mood swings of a prepubescent daughter, while Carissa wasn't used to the cramped living situation the apartment offered. The walls between the two bedrooms were thin, and Carissa could hear everything going on between Penny and Vernon. She also struggled to adapt to her mother's more strict rules. While Carissa had lived with her father, she was allowed to stay up until 11 p.m., whereas with Penny, there was a strict 9:30 p.m. bedtime. Carissa began detailing her stressful experience in her new living situation in various diaries and journals, and each time she tried to have a conversation about how she was feeling with her mother, Penny, it would erupt into an argument. Eventually, the situation came to a head, and Vernon told Penny that something needed to change. He suggested that the two of them needed to talk things out, and he couldn't keep coming home to a screaming match. On Sunday, January 27th, 2008, Penny decided to take Carissa on a drive to have a heart-to-heart conversation in an attempt to improve the relationship with her daughter. Around 4 p.m., Penny knocked on Carissa's bedroom door and told her to get dressed so they could head out for a drive together. The two drove in Penny's bright red 2000 Dodge Neon from Bridgewater to Lunenburg, where they sat at a World Heritage site that overlooked the Atlantic Ocean. According to Penny, she tried to encourage Carissa to open up to her about the problems they were having as a result of their new living situation. The topic of Carissa seeing a counselor came up, but Carissa refused this idea. Carissa became emotional and asked her mom to try to ignore her rages. The conversation seemed to be going in circles. So, defeated, Penny headed to Sobeys, where she entered the store alone to grab some juice and some bacon. The first major snowstorm of the season was forecasted to hit the region hard that night. Up to 10 centimeters of snow was slated to fall. Carissa opted to stay in the car while her mother went inside. When Penny got to the checkout area of the store, she looked outside at her car, and then she made her way to the payphones inside the store where she attempted to call her boyfriend Vernon, but he did not answer. Penny left a voicemail informing Vernon that Carissa was no longer inside the car and had vanished.
Around 8:30 on the evening of January 27, 2008, Bridgewater Police Sergeant Al Cunningham was on the graveyard shift. It was anticipated to be a relatively quiet shift with a winter storm bearing down on the region. It was 8:32 p.m. when the phone rang. Paula Cardinal, who was a police dispatcher, answered. On the other end was a mother, clearly distraught about her daughter whom she feared had run away from the Sobeys parking lot. Penny Boudreau explained that she and her daughter had argued before she went into the store to grab some items. And when she returned to her vehicle, her daughter was not there. Paula took the description of the girl, 12 years old, shoulder-length brown hair, 5 feet tall, 130 pounds, blue eyes, and wearing a black hoodie, a black vest, blue jeans, and pink Crocs. She was not wearing any gloves or a hat and didn't have a purse with her. Paula asked if she had a cell phone, and Penny told her no. Paula tried to reassure Penny that her daughter would likely return home after cooling off and promised to pass the information on to the patrol officers. In the meantime, she told Penny to make a list of contacts to call and check to see if they had seen Carissa. Later that night, Sergeant Cunningham spoke with Penny Boudreau over the phone. She told him the same story that she had told Paula at dispatch. He made notes that Penny had been having issues with Carissa in regards to attitude, and that she was having a difficult time adjusting to her new home at 220 Jubilee Road. Cunningham was not immediately concerned. It had been less than 3 hours since Penny had last seen her daughter, and he assumed it was most likely that she was a runaway. However, the impending storm prompted him to start the search efforts immediately. But first, the sergeant wanted to pop by Penny's apartment to pick up a picture of Carissa. He pulled up to 220 Jubilee Road, a red brick three-story apartment building, and knocked at the door. Penny answered and let him inside. Upon entry, he met Penny's boyfriend, Vernon McCumber, a frail-looking, tall, and thin middle-aged man. The sergeant explained that he needed a photo of Carissa, and Penny handed him one of her 8x10 school photos to take with him. Cunningham couldn't quite put his finger on what it was, but something seemed off, and he was motivated to get boots on the ground quickly. At 11 p.m., multiple officers met up in the Sobeys parking lot where Carissa was last seen. They knew it was likely that she fled on foot and that she wasn't dressed for below-freezing temperatures. They initiated a territorial search with a bloodhound, but after 20 minutes had passed, it was clear the falling snow was impeding their search efforts. They called off the search for the rest of the night and had a meeting back at the detachment about what they learned so far. The following is quoted from the book Mommy Don't. Cunningham's report read, "At 0200 hours, the search was called off. Paula ComTech did a terrific job, constantly in contact with the mother and updating. Contact was made with her biological father in Shelbourne, and made him aware of the missing report. 0300 Hours advised Penny that there was nothing more that we could do at this hour, and to update us in the AM if she heard anything. At 3 a.m., Shane Boudreaux, who by now was aware his niece was missing, called the police to tell them that he was worried Carissa had been kidnapped. Sergeant Cunningham tried to reassure Shane that in all likelihood, Carissa was likely safe somewhere and would return in the morning. But in reality, the sergeant was doubtful. However, he kept that to himself. There wasn't much more the police could do in the wee hours of January 28, 2008, so the sergeant typed out his pass-on report for the incoming shift, which started at 0700 hours. It read, "We've searched all night, checked the rear of the Sobeys, in the dumpsters, along the riverbank, and even a visit to the highway parkways where the homeless people seek shelter to stay warm. All negative. Nothing is found. We have exhausted all efforts."
At 11 a.m. on the morning after Carissa disappeared, Shane Boudreaux was feeling restless. He had been like a father to Carissa from the moment she was born and knew that she would never disappear like this on her own. He'd had enough of trying to get information by calling the police and decided it was time to drive down to the station with his sister-in-law, Chastity Greer. He demanded to speak to someone working the case. Constable Wade Keddy met Shane and Chastity and brought them to a small room with a Kleenex box on the table. He informed them about all the efforts that were being made to find Carissa, that police were in the middle of arranging a press conference, as well as following up with any contacts who may have seen or heard from Carissa. The police could offer no more information, and with that, Shane and Chastity left not feeling much better about the situation. A woman named Jennifer, who also lived at the apartments at 220 Jubilee Road, had been called by Penny at 3 a.m. They ran up to Penny's apartment to see what they could do to help. They offered condolences and to help put up missing posters around town. But to their surprise, Penny declined their offer and told them not to worry and that she had already put up some posters. This reaction caught them off guard. They knew if it was them in Penny's shoes, they would be out searching all over town, unable to sit still in an apartment, and desperate to plaster Carissa's face far and wide. Paul Boudreaux and his new girlfriend were next to arrive in Bridgewater after hearing that Carissa had gone missing. They too spent all afternoon searching. Paul couldn't ignore the nagging feeling that the Penny he once knew and had a child with had changed after she and his brother Shane had split up. Penny wasn't as nice as she used to be, and had a more heartless and cold edge to her. What stood out the most to Paul was thinking back to the previous summer when he observed Penny seemingly caring less and less about Carissa and more about her new relationship with Vernon. When Paul arrived at the apartment, he observed Penny's behavior, and he immediately didn't think that she was as distraught as a mother whose child is missing should be. While they were all sitting on the couch inside the apartment that afternoon, the radio station CKBW aired the following police bulletin. Bridgewater Police Service are requesting the public's assistance in locating a missing 12-year-old girl from the Bridgewater area. The young girl was last seen by her mother at approximately 5:30 p.m. last night after a verbal argument in the parking lot of the Sobey store on LaHave Street. The young girl's name is Carissa Paige Boudreaux. Date of birth is October 4th, 1995. When Paul caught Penny's reaction to this message, it angered him. Instead of appearing emotional, distraught, or concerned about Carissa, she was soothing Vernon, who was complaining about a sore leg. At this, Paul and Chastity abruptly stood up and left Penny's apartment.
Back at the police station, it was around 7 p.m. when Sergeant Al Cunningham was instructed by his boss to bring Penny Boudreaux into the detachment so she could provide a formal statement. Penny told him that she and Carissa had eaten breakfast together that morning. Carissa had a peanut butter sandwich, and Penny recalled having difficulty connecting with her. She told the sergeant that her daughter was moody and that she felt like she was constantly walking on eggshells when talking to her. According to Penny, Carissa spent the rest of the day in her room watching TV while Vernon was asleep in the other room. The next time Penny saw Carissa was around lunchtime when Carissa asked if she could have Subway for lunch. Penny agreed and picked up a 6-inch cold-cut combo for Carissa, who took the sandwich and went back to her room. She sat in her room and ate her lunch and listened to music. Penny told Cunningham that her daughter enjoyed being alone in her room doing solo activities. Penny said it must have been around 4 p.m. when she knocked at her daughter's bedroom door to invite her out for a drive and to have a conversation. Sergeant Cunningham wanted the details of where exactly Penny and Carissa had gone for their drive that afternoon. Penny told him that they went to Lunenburg, which is about a half hour away, and then turned around at the animal hospital to head back to Bridgewater. According to Penny, the atmosphere inside the vehicle was tense. There had been some discussion of getting Carissa into counseling due to her lack of respect, common sense, and her tendency to isolate herself. This elicited an angry reaction from Carissa, who told Penny that she didn't want to go to a therapist. Penny didn't back down and told her daughter that she didn't have any say in the matter and that she would attend a session. Penny told Cunningham that it was a parent's job to do everything possible that they could, especially when their child was acting so withdrawn. She also mentioned that Carissa had made it clear that she didn't like living in the apartment with Penny and Vernon, and that she had even asked her daughter if she'd be happier living elsewhere. But Carissa told Penny that she just didn't know. Penny continued to express her concerns to Sergeant Al Cunningham about her daughter Carissa's behavior. She described Carissa as being of two minds, kind at times, but also rude and disrespectful. Sergeant Cunningham sought more information about Carissa's living situation before moving in with Penny and Vernon. Penny explained that Carissa had lived with her father, Paul, but had difficulties with Paul's new girlfriend. Once at Penny's apartment, the complaints started, with Carissa expressing her dislike for their new living arrangement after the divorce. Penny recounted the events leading up to Carissa's disappearance, including the moment she discovered her missing from the car after shopping at Sobeys. She conducted a search, then called the police around 8 p.m., and she stated that she appreciated the assistance from the dispatcher, Paula. Trying to explore potential leads, Cunningham asked Penny who Carissa respected the most among herself, Paul, and Shane. Penny thought Shane was more likely the person, as Carissa blamed her mother for the divorce. When Cunningham asked if Carissa might harm herself, Penny didn't believe so. However, Cunningham observed peculiarities in Penny's language and behavior, noting instances where Penny referred to her daughter as it and avoided eye contact. Before concluding the interview, Cunningham asked if Penny knew where Carissa might have gone, to which Penny said she had no idea. He also asked about Carissa's relationship with Penny's boyfriend, Vernon, and Penny mentioned that they got along well. With this information, Sergeant Cunningham concluded the interview.
We're now going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Before Penny left the station, Cunningham told her they'd like to come back to the apartment to pick up some of Carissa's belongings, including Carissa's cell phone, to assist with their investigation. As Cunningham continued with his notes, he wrote, "If Carissa is not located, a statement analysis should be performed on this statement and/or Penny Boudreau should be polygraphed. There are some issues with the words used, like she or her instead of my daughter or Carissa." Sergeant Al Cunningham felt something was off with Penny's story as he drove over to their apartment at around 10:30 p.m. that night. When the officers arrived, they went straight to Carissa's room, where they located some papers that had been buried in her closet. They read as follows. December 2nd, 2007. I'm sad because I have to go to school tomorrow. I miss Shane and Tracy. I have to go to bed at 9:30 instead of 11. I live in an apartment. There's no room for my stuff. I feel crowded. End of story. My life sucks until we live in a house. I'm mad because my mom is engaged to Vernon. Mom made me move here. Mom broke up with Shane. I want a bigger room. I don't like Vernon living with us. The end. My life is ruined. By Carissa. As the officers read these notes, they shared some side glances with each other. Had Carissa fled? These notes certainly lent more credence to the runaway theory. They bagged the notes into evidence and left the apartment. The following day, January 29, 2008, Penny Boudreau had agreed to do a televised press conference in an effort to find Carissa. Penny sat at a table filled with microphones, and seated next to her was her fiancé, Vernon McCumber. Behind Penny was Paul Boudreau, Carissa's father, as well as Paul's mother, Suzanne. Penny looked exhausted as she spoke into the camera and retold the story that she had already told the police. She emphasized that Carissa was not going to be in any trouble and that everyone just wanted her home. It was then time for the reporters to ask questions. One asked what it was like for a mother to go through this. Penny's face reacted initially with anger, and then she said, "It had been pure hell. Not knowing where your child is horrible." Acting Chief Deputy John Collier then stepped up to the microphone, letting the public know what was most disturbing for the police was the fact that Carissa was not dressed for the conditions outside. He went on to detail some of the search efforts that police had done, such as searching the LaHave riverbanks, as well as reviewing CCTV footage from Sobeys and the nearby stores. When asked by reporters if parents should be keeping their kids at home, suggesting a kidnapper may be on the loose, the police told them no, and then wrapped up the press conference.
One of the primary investigators on the case was Detective Sergeant Scott Feener, who was also the missing persons file manager. He was a mild-mannered man who began his policing career in 1988 in Toronto. When he was 24, he moved back east to join the Bridgewater Police. He was now managing one of the biggest cases of his career, and he was determined to find the missing 12-year-old girl, Carissa Boudreau, alive. It was around 4 p.m. on January 29, 2008, when a man came into the Bridgewater Police Station wanting to make a report of an item of interest that he found in the snow on the shoulder of William Hebb Road. It was a single pink croc. Immediately, police sent a team to the spot where the man had located the shoe. William Hebb Road is located south of Bridgewater and is relatively rural. Parts of it are paved, while others are gravel. So when the man saw the bright pink croc on top of a pile of snow, it very much stood out to him. This wasn't an area where people would frequent. The police brought a tracking dog with them, but were unable to find any other items of interest. Police had treated Carissa's case with suspicion from the start, but the find of one of her shoes in a wooded location heightened their concern. The police decided to keep the discovery of Carissa's shoe from the public, as they believed it would be valuable information in the investigation. They also sent the croc off to a forensic lab to test it for DNA to determine whether or not the shoe belonged to Carissa Boudreau. While they waited for those results to come back, they brought the shoe to Penny to see if she recognized it. She did, but she couldn't confirm 100% whether or not it belonged to her daughter. Penny had no further questions or reaction to the police officers after they located the pink croc, other than to admit it was odd that they found it in the middle of nowhere.
It likely won't come as much of a surprise to anyone that the police began focusing their investigation on the two people that they knew had seen Carissa last, her mother Penny, and Penny's boyfriend, Vernon McCumber. Detective Sergeant Feener now wanted to bring them both in for a pure version statement. This entails having a skilled interviewer ask open-ended questions while simply listening to the subject narrate the events without any interruption, letting them fill all the awkward silences. The following interviews are going to be read from the book Mommy Don't, written by Sherry Aikenhead. Today's date is January 30th, and we're at the Bridgewater Police Department. That's at 45 Exhibition Drive. I'm Constable Mitchell, but you can call me Trevor. Okay, replied Penny. We're investigating the disappearance of your daughter, Carissa, and I understand you provided a written statement to Sergeant Al Cunningham on Monday. It's Wednesday now, so sometimes things change a bit in your memory, and you'll think of details that you didn't think of at the time. I want you to go back to Sunday. Take your time. Stay cool, calm, and relaxed, and tell me everything that happened. Everything you say is very, very important, so take your time. Just go back, close your eyes. We've got all day. Penny started. I don't know what time we got up. Maybe around 9 or 10. Vernon was still sleeping, so we let him sleep in, and me and her had breakfast. I think she had a peanut butter sandwich, and I had an egg. We talked a little bit, but the girl doesn't talk a lot, especially in the morning, and she wanted to know if she could go back to her room. I said, well, if that's what you want to do. She came back out again close to lunchtime and said she was hungry. She wanted to know what we were having, and I said, I don't know. She had a Subway card from Christmas, so she wanted to know if I would go get her a sub, and I said sure, and ran and got her a sub and brought it back to the apartment. She took it to her room to eat it alone. She always wanted to be alone. Around 4 o'clock, I think it was, I knocked on her bedroom door and asked her if she wanted to go for a drive with me, that I wanted to talk with her, and she said okay. She got dressed, and we probably left a few minutes later. I had no direction or anywhere we should go. I was just driving slow and aimlessly. I just wanted her to talk where she couldn't run off and shut the door. You know, get away and have a mother-daughter heart-to-heart. We had thought about getting her a counselor because she would not talk, and when she does, it's to snap or be mean. It's very stressful to live in a house where everybody's on eggshells. You know, you're scared they're gonna snap or whatever. We drove around and I ended up in Lunenburg. I turned around at the animal hospital. We came back. I wandered around town, still driving and talking. She's just so sad. I know she blames me for the divorce, but I mean, that's typical for kids. I just kept asking her what would make her happy. I never thought she would disappear. I never thought there would be no sign of her. We ended up at Sobeys and I wanted to get some juice before I went home and she didn't want to come in. I was only there for a few minutes and when I came out, she was gone. I didn't panic at first. I figured, you know, after the talk, she wanted to cool off, so I drove around town, hoping to see her. I drove around and around. I didn't see her. I went home to wait. Maybe she may have already been at somebody's house. Me and Vernon waited an hour, and no sign of her, so we called here, and it was Paula that answered, and she said, stay calm until 10 p.m. and then call her friends. That's what I did. And Paula did a lot of calling for me. She was really good, courteous yesterday. I think she was awesome. I don't know if anybody else recognized how awesome she is. She kept me sane that first night, I'll put it that way. We walked ourselves physically along the banks of the river and through the woods. I don't know what else I can do. I'm at a loss. I was the last one with her, so I feel responsible. I don't know what more I can tell you. I just sat up all night trying to rack my brain as to what I could think of that I missed. I never experienced anything like this ever. I honestly have no idea. It was then that Mitchell steered Penny back to the events of that night, saying, okay, let's get back to the Sobeys parking lot. Just go back in your mind, you know, take your time, close your eyes and think when you pulled into the Sobeys parking lot, everything you said and everything she said. Penny said, well, we both weren't talking a whole lot because we were on our way home and nobody knew what they wanted to do and I told her she was getting a counselor. She didn't want it, but I said, well, you got to talk to somebody. It's not healthy to live isolated and moody. She said, well, fine, whatever. We parked very close to the door and I could see the car from the checkout. That's when I could tell. I first noticed she wasn't there, because I was watching the car and the cashier was ringing in my stuff. Then I used the payphone. I remember saying, well, asking her if she wanted to come in. And she goes, no, I don't like shopping. I don't want nothing to do with going in with you. Mitchell then reminded Penny to tell him about their conversation, saying, everything's important here. Penny said, I didn't say a whole lot when we started out. I just told her I wanted to talk about her behavior and the fact that she had no respect for anybody else in the house. It's all about her, and that's little kids' attitudes sometimes. But she's always been like that from the time she was little. I said, what can I do to make you happy? She got frustrated and started crying, and she blamed me. I said, well, how come you're okay with Shane being happy? That's my ex-husband, and he's got a girlfriend, and that's okay, and you're not mad at him for being happy. And she blamed me. She felt he had a right to be happy and I didn't because I caused the divorce. I said, that's not true. Everybody has the right to be happy and it takes more than one to cause a divorce. And I just left that alone. I said, would she be happier living with her real dad again? Because she seemed happier. And she said no because she didn't like his girlfriend. And I'm like, well, you can't have everything. I said, what do you want me to do to try and make things better for you? She said, "You have no business talking to me. Don't look at me. Just leave me alone, and that'll make me happy." I said, "I can't live in a house where people are just stuck constantly yelling at you, raging at you." And she said, "Just ignore my rages." And I said, "You can't live like that." And she said, "Well, that's what grown-ups should do." She just kept insisting she wasn't happy, but she didn't know what would make her happy. I don't know, we were both at a loss what to do. "Where were you?" Mitchell asked. "We were just driving slowly. We meandered around town some more. I stopped in the shipyard to talk and just sit still." She said, "I'm going to tell everybody you're being mean to me." And I said, "I'm not being mean to you. I'm just trying to reach you because you're hurt and you're sad." And she said it would be better if she made people not like me. She said somebody would take her and make her happy. I said, "Christ, if anyone can make you happy, it'd be your family." And she said nobody wanted her. And I said, "We've all tried." Penny then said, "It's like I didn't even know her." After about an hour had passed, the cop left to get her some water. And then they watched Penny on the CCTV camera that was recording her while they were away. She said, "Miss you, Carissa. Where are you? I just want to help you. I wish I had a clue on how to find you, Carissa. I'd come get you in a heartbeat. I want you back. I want to get you help." When the police officer returned, he asked Penny to reenact the activities of the day that Carissa went missing backwards. So from the time she went missing to the time they left the house. And they often do this to determine how truthful someone is being. After 2 hours of interviewing, it was wrapped up saying, "Is there anything else, Penny, anything you can think of that you want to say? If something comes up, certainly call us." And then Penny finished by saying, "I'm just so lost. I just want to help her so much. I mean, if we find her, she's in trouble for what she's done. That's for sure."
After they wrapped things up with Penny, it was Vernon's turn. Vernon McCumber was born on February 7th, 1963 in Toronto, Ontario. There were periods of Vernon's life where he was bouncing around from small town to small town, often with no fixed address. He had previously been married, and there were instances of violence in that relationship that eventually led to a divorce in 2003. In June of 2004, RCMP responded to a call about a man threatening to harm himself. It was Vernon. The responding officer detained Vernon and brought him into a hospital for psychiatric help. But Vernon refused, violently. He assaulted the officer. He ended up with a suspended sentence and agreed to get mental health help.
So let's go ahead and get into Vernon's Pure Version Statement interview, also read from Mommy Don't by Sherry Aikenhead. "My name is Constable Mitchell, but you can call me Trevor. Okay, Trevor, it's just been hell. I don't know what to do. I want to be there for Penny, but my God, it's horrible." At this point, Mitchell just asks Vernon to go through the events of the day on Sunday, the day Carissa went missing, letting him know we've got all day. Nice and calm, cool, collected, all of that. "Okay, Sunday. Began by getting up around 10. They usually let me sleep because, you know, I get different shifts where I work Saturday, too. So I got up and I knew Penny was going to have a talk, right? About, you know, because we were really worried about Carissa. But I think she just seemed very frustrated at times. Like, never mean to me or anything, but just with her mom. I'm not the bad guy, right? But it seemed like she had to talk to her about her attitude, to get her some help or something, to talk to somebody. She didn't want to talk to us, right? We just knew her attitude was getting, like, bad. You know, we were concerned. I said, I'll get up. I had a tall Milwaukee in the fridge, and I said, do you guys want me to go with you? And she said, no. She just wanted a one-on-one with her without her hollering. Because they do get to hollering like they will. She'll holler, and she just don't want to talk. She would just holler first and then run to her room. I don't know what time it was when they left, and I had my beer and I said, I'm going to lay down. It might have been later, because I can't remember how late it was when they left in the afternoon. Then all of it started out normal. Carissa came out of her room. We talked. She showed me her knee socks. When she left, she said, do you like my socks? And I said, yeah, I think they're cool. She was a sweet kid. I mean, she is a good kid. With that, I was just worried about her welfare. Kids shouldn't be in trouble when they're young, right? You know what I mean? He then moved back to the events of Sunday afternoon. I'm laying down. I was never a phone person anyway. I didn't know she was trying to get a hold of me. I heard the phone ring several times, and I just laid back down and drifted off to sleep. I guess she came. Well, I guess it was around 5:30 or so, and I was still in bed, and Penny's frantic, of course. She panics. You know, because she loved her daughter. I mean, that's all I ever do is love her daughter, right? always so kind with her and don't want to get her upset, right? She said Carissa had jumped out of the car and took off, and I said, well, just calm down now, tell me exactly, don't panic. It's just that she probably went out to vent. That's what I did when I was a kid and got mad at my parents. I went outside to play. I told her, don't panic. She might be on her way home now, because it's only within half an hour. So anyway, I said, well, we're going to wait till about 6:30 or 6 o'clock. I'm not quite sure, but I said, we're going to wait. At 7 o'clock, we're calling the police. We've got to get them out there looking for her, because, you know, she wasn't dressed. I mean, she only had on socks and normal shoes. The girl's been through a divorce, and it must affect the child, right? I don't want her to think I was coming in trying to take over Shane's spot or her dad's spot. She wasn't happy. She didn't want to stay with her dad no more, and of course, I'm going to let her, you know, come back with us. Penny's her mom, and I love her too. I mean, there was not much more I can tell you. I tell you, my friends, this is just a nightmare. It's like a bad dream. Really, I had no idea she was so troubled. It just seemed like she was bothered, different than other kids. The cop then asked Vernon if foul play was involved in Carissa's disappearance, what Vernon thought should happen to the person that was responsible. And he answered, I just think that they're a waste of life. Honestly, I think you hurt a child. You shouldn't be here. Later on in the interview, the cop said that he sympathized with Vernon, but as they continued with their investigation, that they might need to polygraph him. Vernon said, yeah, I haven't got a problem with that. I don't care. I just want it so we can go other ways and then you can look other ways. It's all right with me. And Vernon finished saying, oh my God, this is a nightmare.
So immediately comparing Vernon's interview to Penny's, police observed that Vernon seemed much more emotionally upset than Penny did. Penny seemed cool and calculated, while Vernon seemed quite devastated by it all. They also noted that Vernon mentioned that he and Carissa had a good relationship. However, the police knew that Carissa wrote in her diary that she wasn't his biggest fan. The next move for police was to inspect Penny's car to take a look for any sign of a struggle. Penny and Vernon agreed to the search, so on Wednesday, January 30th, the same day they interviewed the couple, the police began to search Penny's 2000 Dodge Neon. They found strands of brown hair on the passenger side floor mat and bagged them. Police also ended up taking the entire floor mat into evidence. The officers also collected Carissa's hairbrush, toothbrush, and retainer for forensic testing, as well as two more diaries found in her bedroom. While the police were waiting for the DNA results from the pink croc to come back, they were running out of avenues of inquiry. So it was decided that another press conference would be held to stir up more tips from the public.
Speaking of the public, the rumor in town was that Carissa had drowned in the LaHave River, and on Thursday, January 31st, 2008, the police helicopter was hovering above the river in search of any sign of Carissa. The aerial search spanned more than 60 kilometers and unfortunately yielded no results. The missing girl was all the town of Bridgewater could talk about, and residents could not sit still and do nothing. Parents of children at Bridgewater Elementary started Hearts for Carissa, which were wooden heart-shaped pins that were sold for $2, and the proceeds went directly to Penny. Everyone wanted Penny to know that they were thinking of her. The police also wanted Penny to know that she was supported and that there were resources available to her should she need them. They told Penny all about Carissa's classmates and their parents who were out selling hearts for Carissa, and that Carissa's missing poster was put up in every single Sobeys store from Bridgewater to Quebec. The police were doing everything they could to comfort Penny, who was unemotional when in the presence of law enforcement. Penny declined the offer of victim services, citing that her co-workers at Atlantic Superstore had raised money and food for her and Vernon. Speaking of Superstore, it's actually where Penny and Vernon met as they both worked at the store. Staff and shoppers were so moved by one of their own going through the nightmare of a child going missing that they were able to raise over $10,000 for Penny and Vernon. So on February 1st, 2008, the second press briefing was held. In attendance was Bev Ware, a reporter for the Chronicle Herald. She took a seat at the table while they waited for the family of Carissa Boudreau to arrive. Through the doors came Penny, Vernon, Paul, and Carissa's step-aunt, Chastity. Penny wore a blue turtleneck and looked worn. Vernon sat next to her in a tan and brown jacket with gold-rimmed glasses, looking shell-shocked. We played a bit of the audio from this news conference in the intro of this episode, And a shout out to Jordan from the Nighttime Podcast for compiling that audio, as it has seemed a lot of Penny's press briefings have been scrubbed from the internet. This plea from Penny was very similar to the first one that she did. She asked for someone to come forward, and if Carissa was listening, to please reach out to her family. Penny once again described the car ride with her daughter and how the two had been having a heated argument that day, but made sure to clarify that it wasn't a big argument. She didn't want the door slammed in her face or for Carissa to have the ability to just walk away from the conversation like she usually did. Bev Ware was having a difficult time connecting with the supposedly grief-stricken mother in front of her. She found Penny's behavior off and not quite as frantic as she figured a mother would be in the event of their child disappearing. Police stepped in to give more information as to how their investigation was going. They told the news cameras that they had followed up on every tip that came in and that members of the public had called in with alleged sightings of Carissa, but they hadn't been able to confirm the legitimacy of those tips. The police kept the discovery of the pink croc close to the vest, but they did let the public know that all of their aerial searches of the river turned up negative results, and they were 90% sure that Carissa was not in the water. With that, the second press briefing wrapped.
By now, the investigators were beginning to lose hope. It had been nearly 2 weeks since Carissa had vanished, and they knew the odds of finding her alive were dwindling. Meanwhile, a woman named Danielle, who worked at the Atlantic Superstore with Penny and Vernon, was feeling uneasy about an interaction she had with them while ringing in their groceries at the store. She asked Penny if there was anything new in the investigation, and Penny was indifferent when she told her no, nothing was new. Danielle found Penny's demeanor odd enough that she decided to go to the police with her concerns. She told investigators about her experience, but also added context by telling them about a conversation she had with Penny and Vernon in November of 2007, just months before Carissa went missing. She recalled being on a smoke break with Vernon while he confided in her that Carissa was getting in the way of his relationship with Penny, but that he didn't want to go through another breakup. At this point, the police knew they had to shift gears and bring in help from the RCMP's major crime unit. The media were also all over law enforcement, asking whether or not they believed that members of the family were involved with Carissa's disappearance. All that the police would confirm is that they did suspect foul play in connection with the missing girl. However, when speaking to the Bridgewater Bulletin newspaper, police said that they didn't have any evidence pointing to criminality and that there was no reason to suspect anyone in the family, as they were all fully cooperating. This did not prevent the community of Bridgewater from speculating, and it seemed that the town was convinced that Vernon had something to do with Carissa's disappearance. Even members of the family were starting to get feelings of unease, specifically Carissa's step-aunt, Chastity, who confided in friends that she feared Vernon and Penny knew more than they were letting on. We're going to end it here for part one of Carissa Boudreau's case. Part two will be up in your feed bright and early tomorrow morning. And with that, stay safe, everyone.
Stay safe.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.